Hello, and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Andrew Jordan Nance has been an educator for 30 years. He is the founder of Mindful Arts San Francisco, whose mission is to provide volunteer educators to teach at underserved San Francisco schools. He is the author of several children's books, including the adorable and best-selling Puppy Mind. He's also written Mindful Arts in the Classroom, The Lion in Me, and The Barefoot King. Andrew is also an award-winning actor and director who taught performing arts to students from diverse backgrounds as a conservatory director at San Francisco's new Conservatory Theater Center for 18 years. He is on the board of several educational nonprofit organizations, including the Mindful Life Project in Richmond, California, and Arts Ed Matters, a California-based arts integration organization. Andrew, what a pleasure to welcome you to Balanced Body Radio.
Thank you so much, Casey. I appreciate it.
Such an honor. As soon as I saw your book, I bought it, and it is tremendous. It is so, so well done. So I am just going to go ahead and ask you the number one question you have to answer all the time. I'm going to make you answer it right off the bat. Where was this book when I was growing up?
Oh, I love it. I know. I feel the same way. I wish social emotional learning had been there for all of us because, you know, I think we've spent our whole lives sort of trying to chase after after happiness. And, you know, it's really such an important gift to just be able to know that we can choose not to suffer even through painful situations. We can be and hold the pain or the joy or the freneticism with some grace if we only had the skills to, you know, when we were little.
Yeah, you are not describing my childhood, buddy. Not even a little bit. I want to talk about you and your story, but before we do, can you tell the reader a little bit about Puppy Mind, how that idea came to be and how the storyline kind of goes?
Yeah, I had been teaching mindfulness for about a year in schools, and I thought, you know, I'm going to find some mindful books to read to the kids because they like to be read to. So I went to a spiritual bookstore and they really only had a few, and some of them were, you know, really badly made, you know, badly published. They didn't draw me in, but I found one that I brought into the kids and I read it to them, and I could just see their little faces kind of, you know, die a little bit. They were not into it. So I thought, you know, I've got a couple of ideas in my head. So I went home and I wrote like four children's books on my dining room table in the course of a couple of hours, you know, like the first draft of them at any rate. And so the next week I brought in Puppy Mind and I read Puppy Mind to them. And the teacher came up to me afterwards and said, you know, that's actually really good. You might want to talk to a publisher or something. And I said, really? Okay. You know, I just never thought of writing a book at all. So one thing led to another, and I met a publisher, or a friend of mine knew a publisher, and we had a meeting, and a couple months later, she gave me a two-book deal, and that was Puppy Mind and The Lion in Me. And Puppy Mind, basically, the concept is an old Buddhist concept of that wandering monkey mind. But to me, I just didn't like the idea that we wanted to tame or train a monkey. I just thought, you know, we just don't relate to that in this Western world of ours. However, we have had dogs in our lives for thousands and thousands of years. So I like the idea of contemporizing it a little bit and bringing in the idea that we have this wandering puppy mind that we can train to stay with us more. And as long as we're kind to our minds, and we do that by using our breath, whenever we notice that our mind has wandered off playfully, usually or often, we take a breath and we just bring it back with kindness.
Mm. Man, I love that. It's such a great story. With children books, though, it's really, you know, you have to have the great story, but you also need to have really engaging pictures. And you certainly went out and find the right illustrator to be able to do that. I think anybody who ever, you know, was familiar with Clifford would recognize the illustrations. What did it mean to you to be able to work with Jim?
Oh my gosh, it was so cool. And in fact, there was a lot of woo-woo things that happened along this journey. But one of them was I went on to Facebook and I said, hey, does anyone know an illustrator who can draw like Clifford the Big Red Dog or Curious George? And within 5 minutes, my friend Steve reached out and said, oh, well, I went to school with the guy who draws Clifford the Big Red Dog now. And so... A day and a half later, Jim Dirk and I, the illustrator, were talking on the phone and he had never heard of mindfulness, but I hopefully explained it to him in a way that made sense. And he said, yeah, I'd be willing to give this a go. And so we've actually never met. We've never FaceTimed or Zoomed or anything. We've just talked on the phone and through email. And we've been collaborating on 2 books in the last 4 years. So it's been a really beautiful partnership.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And anybody that we show this book to definitely feels the same way, that it's just so well done and such a cool story. I would like to go back a little bit and talk about you and your story. What was it like for you growing up? Were you just always a little mindful kid ready to write a bunch of awesome children's books?
Right. No, I wasn't that. I did grow up in an interesting household. My parents were actually deaf. And so I really had to be present with them in order to, understand what they were saying, for them to understand me. You know, I couldn't really look away or, you know, kind of mumble to them. I actually had to look them in the eye. They had to look me in the eye. My mom was born deaf, so she had a speech pattern that was a little bit harder to understand for a lot of people. For me, primarily, I could understand her, almost 100% of the time. My father lost his hearing when he was 16, so he could be understood by people more easily than my mom. But and we fingerspelled, we did some signing with each other, but they primarily spoke to me using English, not American Sign Language. Mm-hmm. So I think that helped me be more focused. And then I got, sort of more present moment awareness stuff. And then I got interested in theater really early on, probably when I was 11 or 12, and started doing plays in school and whatnot. I was the star of The Ugly Duckling in the third grade. I just loved it.
And how do we miss that in the intro?
I know. I can't believe you left that out.
Leave with that on LinkedIn.
I'll have to talk to my publicist. Anyway. So I got into theater and I just loved, I loved everything about theater, from the costumes to playing different characters. I loved, I kind of felt like I was a character actor throughout my career. And I just loved everything about it. And then I started, I went to New York University to study theater and got a degree from there. And then I studied at La Mama over in Italy a number of years ago and, had a pretty good theater career in San Francisco while I was running a theater school and just loved it. I got to direct and produce and, of course, act and won some awards along the way. And I realized after I left that theater job, as the conservatory director, and I started studying mindfulness, I realized how similar mindfulness and theater training were. Both invite the participants to connect with the present moment, to use your breath when emotions are getting too big for you to handle. Imagine that you're about to go on stage and it's opening night or it's the first preview. And, you just have to calm your body. You have to say, it's okay. I get it. You're nervous, but we've practiced for this. We've trained, we've rehearsed. You know what you're doing. When in doubt, just take a breath. Wiggle your toes, listen, connect with the other people on stage, and we're gonna get through this with some skill. And that's exactly what mindfulness is as well, to just connect with what's happening in the present moment, to use your breath, to check in with your mind, heart, and your body so that you can make the most skillful choice possible in the this moment, and then the next, and then the next. The thing that I would say is different about the two trainings is that on stage, we do want to be reactive. You know, they say on when you're in theater school, you know, acting is reacting. And I do believe that. However, with mindfulness, you want to respond to a situation, right? You know, they say police officers want to respond to a situation. And ideally, of course, that's what we want them to do as well. But oftentimes, as we know, they react to a situation. So we want to respond wisely to a situation rather than react blindly to a situation. And on stage, we want that appearance of reacting blindly. But of course, there's a lot of rehearsal involved and whatnot. So there's that mindful part of it as well. Mm.
Yeah, that's a really interesting connection to connect the two. That wouldn't have been, you know, totally obvious to me. Was there an event or something that happened in your life that made you need to find mindfulness as a tool?
Great question. Yes, I am now 56, and like a lot of people, you know, you're sort of chasing your dreams through your 20s and your 30s and your 40s. And you think, you know, when I get that job, or when I get this amount of money, or when I get this house, or when I go on this trip or this partner or whatever, this experience, I'm going to have made it. You know, I'm going to feel good for the rest of my life is sort of what the mind tricks you, or maybe it's even the ego tricks us into believing that if we can just attain certain things, we'll find some base level of happiness. And as I got older and I realized, gosh, I've all these great things in my life, partner and work that I love and all this stuff. There are still these days where I just feel like I need outside sources to make me feel better. You know, that might be food or a trip or maybe a cocktail or whatever it was. There were always just something that I felt like, oh, I needed to fill this need with some outside stimuli. And I just felt like, well, that in itself was exhausting. So I just thought there has to be something else that can sustain me when I'm not feeling so great. And that turned out to be mindfulness. And it's because mindfulness asks us to look inward with whatever's going on, even if it's uncomfortable, you know. And so often we have been the word that comes to mind is bamboozled into thinking that, you know, we shouldn't look inward. You know, if I'm feeling uncomfortable, well, let's just fix the uncomfortability. Let's, you know, have a drink, or, you know, or go to a movie, or, you know, eat, or go for a run. You know, it doesn't all have to feel toxic. It can actually be a smart thing, a pleasurable thing to, you know, go exercise, or, you know, go for a swim, or take a walk, or, you know, go watch a good movie, whatever it is. But it always felt like I was just constantly trying to seek outside sources to calm me down. And so mindfulness allowed me to learn how to be with uncomfortability so that I could just witness the uncomfortability. And by doing that, I sort of name it, and then it sort of is tamed. You know, there's this expression in mindfulness called you name it so you can tame it, name it to tame it. And it really does work to just turn inward and just witness when any emotion or thought arises that is hard to deal with. Mm.
How did your life change after making that discovery? I mean, it's quite astounding to realize that it's not a happy, I would say is the right word, but more like a contentment or a joy. And it's always accessible as long as you can slow down and appreciate it. What things in your life changed after you made that discovery?
Right. I became less reactionary. I'm much more able to notice when something just triggers me, you know, and it's my own sort of mechanics at work. It's not like the thing that triggered me really was a bad thing, you know, like maybe someone is driving slow in front of me, you know, that's my, and I feel like the heat in the back of my neck or my brow furrow. And so what I do in instances like that is I just notice, take that breath, and suddenly the person's gone in front of me, you know, or they've sped up, or, you know, I realize, you know, there's a baby in the back seat and they were trying to give them their pacifier or something. And just giving me that pause, that's what I think mindfulness has done the most, is given me that pause before reacting to any sort of stimuli or responding to any sort of stimuli. And it sounds, you know, minor, but it really has transformed my relationships to just like little moments throughout the day, you know, at the checkout counter, you're waiting in line, you're waiting at the post office, you're working with kids, you know, I'm far less easily ruffled when a kid is, you know, I don't know, hitting his desk or something while I'm trying to talk or something like that. And with my partner, I certainly am able to ride the waves of all the, you know, uncomfortability that comes up with living with someone for 32 years. You know?
That's amazing. Congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
That's amazing. You've talked about this before, and I want to make sure that we talk about it here because I think it's really important. There was an experience I had a few weeks ago when a friend of mine was just about to start an Ironman race that she'd been training for. And she said, like, I'm feeling really anxious. Like it was the day before and, you know, race nerves and, you know, there were jellyfish in the water that she'd have to swim through and all this crazy stuff. And she just said that she was feeling really anxious. And I think a past version of myself would have been, you know, like, oh, well, you should feel positive. You should feel this way. You should change it. That we don't want those negative emotions. When really, when I stop to think about it, it's like, you're damn right. You should be anxious. You're going to travel 140 miles on your own tomorrow. Like if you weren't feeling anxious, like I'd be more concerned, but we do that. We label like, this is good. This is bad. This is positive. This is negative. Never be sad. Always be happy. Can you talk about why we maybe need to rethink that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. I really am fascinated that we do label things as negative or positive. You know, anger, and I've said this many times on many podcasts, is a great emotion when you're about ready to leave your abusive partner, or you're in a dark alley, or and someone's coming towards you. You know, so there's no way that's a negative emotion. It's an uncomfortable emotion. It's a hard emotion. It's a difficult emotion, but it certainly isn't negative. It's like anything. I'm trying to think of like a happy experience where you shouldn't be happy, but there are times where, you know, I remember when I was a kid and I was, you know, like five, six years old, and I went to a funeral and I just didn't understand why everyone was so sad, because I didn't really understand the concept of death. So I remember giggling, and my mom told me to stop it. And you know, it's just like, you know, you just have these emotions show up. And if we can't be skillful with anything, if any of the emotions that arise, then we're in trouble. So I think it's not about squelching, you know, mindfulness specifically is not about squelching emotions. It's just to be able to hold them and ride the waves of them with some ease and skill. Yeah. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I absolutely love Pixar movies, and they did such a great job illustrating this, I think, in the movie Inside Out, where Bing Bong was feeling sad and Joy couldn't like make her feel better. It was only when the sad character came over and just sat there and was able to be sad with Bing Bong, then he was fine. So
yeah,
I love the way they illustrate that before Bing Bong dies and I cry every single time.
I know. I've just seen that movie once, and I really loved it. I thought they did a great job with it.
Oh, it's amazing.
You know, One thing I do with the kids all the time, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, is I if I see a kid in the hallway, I'll come up to them and I'll, you know, they might be, you know, upset, and I'll say, oh boy, looks like you're having a big emotion. And they'll nod their head usually, you know, they can't even speak really at that, this point, in their process. And I'll say, do you feel hot or cold? And they'll say hot. And, I'll say, do you feel, little or big? And they'll say, I feel little. And, then I'll, you know, just kind of list this, do this sort of whole little body scan with them. And by the end of it, I'll say, you know, do you think you can wiggle your toes? And if they can, I get a sense that their prefrontal cortex is coming back online and they're starting to wake up a little bit, and coming out of their sort of fight, flight, or freeze, response that they're in. And then I'll see maybe if they can wiggle their nose or raise their eyebrows or something. And if they can do that, I'll say, all right, you think you're ready to go back into class? And they'll nod their head and go back in. And it's just, you know, we just get hijacked by these big emotions and we don't know what to do with them. And like to your point, you know, often we'll say, look, you know, oh, come on, you know, it's no big deal. You know, I'm sure it was nothing, or, you know, whatever, you know, kind of try to negate their experience. I say to people sometimes I feel like we try to make kids just seem a little crazy for wanting that toy back that, you know, was taken away from them, or not getting to have a turn, or, you know, whatever it is. We just sort of, kind of shoot them down a little bit rather than just really validate that, yeah, it's hard to wait your turn. I get it. You know, do you feel hot or cold right now, or whatever it is, or, you know, do you need a hug, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's amazing. What a great way to frame that awareness of emotion. It was a great segue too, because I wanted to ask you, what was it about children that made you want to work with them rather than adults or actors or other people?
Yeah. That's a great question. I've worked with kids for so long that I just sort of, it didn't even really occur to me to work with adults. I don't know why. I love that kids are so impressionable. You know, they can learn languages so quickly. And I often think that, mindfulness is its own language. It's just like math is its own language. And I just think if we can have them embody mindful practices, you know, as early as 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old, it becomes part of their awareness. Like, you know, it's like when you look down and your shoe's untied, you don't even think about it. You just go down there and you tie your shoe. You know, it's that kind of thing that I really want to give to these kids, is that ability, like, oh my gosh, my shoulders are up, my face is hot. There's an emotion here that wants to kind of hijack me. I know what to do. I'm going to take a breath. I'm going to wiggle my toes. I'm going to do a little body scan. And oh my gosh, look at that. My shoulders are down now. I've gotten oxygen to my prefrontal cortex. I'm calming myself down, and now I can be a little bit more skillful. I can still be angry, but I don't have to throw that chair, you know, which was my first thought, or, you know, or hit someone, or, you know, stomp off. I can, you know, have a more measured response to being angry. And what's interesting is, I feel like what I'm trying to do is really kind of create this whole generation of kids that have these tools in their tool belt so they can ride the waves of life with some skill. And what's interesting is my husband actually works at San Quentin Prison, and he does something called restorative justice work with the inmates in there. And it's a group of about 13 guys, and they talk about their crimes and what led up to their crimes. And they basically dive into their emotional landscapes in a really deep way. There's a lot of, revelations, a lot of emotions that come up, and they actually don't even realize that their body has all this information that it's trying to give them every second of the day. And my husband and I talk about, oh, isn't this interesting that I'm doing prevention work and you're sort of doing restorative work? And if only these young men who, you know, were incarcerated when they were 18, 19, 20, before their brains were fully developed, had some of these tools growing up, so they perhaps might have made different choices. Mm. So I think that's why I think I'm so impassioned about working with young people.
Mm. What a cool gift. It must be so fun to come home at the end of the day and both of you talk about your, you know, your work and how it's related and how it's so vastly different. I think it's so important that we reiterate one more time. It's a skill. It's like anything else in life. You don't distinguish mindfulness any differently really than learning English or learning multiplication tables. That's correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And I'd have to say too, it's, you know, sometimes I feel like teaching is really punitive, you know, like if you don't follow directions, I'm going to be mad at you, rather than look how much better you feel when you follow directions or you pay attention or you know how to focus or, you know, figure out ways that for, you know, this is to the teachers out there, is how can we make it feel like this is, I'm teaching you gifts that you're going to be able to use for the rest of your life, rather than I'm going to be mad at you if you don't behave the way I want you to.
Wow. I love that. That's such a great way to look at it, and not exactly the way I was introduced to that.
I know. Sorry about that.
you mentioned the reactivity, you know, you gave the example of a kid getting mad and wanting to throw a chair or something. What other ways do you notice that the children's behavior is affected when they start implementing, you know, breathing and mindful skills?
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was actually nervous about going back into the schools this year. I had taught online and, you know, it wasn't bad. You know, I could see the kids' faces and I knew their names. That was one really good benefit of working on Zoom, is I could see their name underneath them, because I'm working with an entire school. So I have not memorized every kid's name yet. I walked into the school being nervous, and the security guard came up to me and he said, "Oh, Mr. Andrew, good to see you." I said, "Oh, good to see you." And he said, "You know, you're going to see a real big difference in the kids this year. You know, I don't know what it is, but we're just not having as many problems with them. They're not going down to the wellness center. You know, I don't think we've sent anyone home." And I was like, "Oh, okay, well, great. Let's see how it goes." So I had a great day with the kids. And then the next week I came back, another great week. And I found that he was absolutely right, that the kids really have taken to this. It's really in their skin now. And I'm really thrilled that they are able to self-regulate in a way that I don't think they were, you know, a few years ago. Because when I first came to this school, there was a lot of kids that couldn't self-regulate, really got upset easily, you know, would throw things, would hit. And now, you know, we're just not seeing that as much. You know, there's still the class clown and things like that, but none of this sort of, you know, violence that I saw 5 years ago. So I'm really sort of pleased that they have all these skills now that they're using. Wow. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the only thing I seem to hear about is just everything is chaos now that schools are back in and kids were used to, you know, being on Zoom, and now there's all kinds of different, I don't know, like behavior issues and depression, anxiety. And it sounds like you're noticing exactly the opposite.
You know, it's so true. And I want to make sure that I'm not wearing rose-colored glasses, but I've talked to this school social worker, I've talked to the teachers, and, you know, they all say that, yeah, you know, kids are actually doing really well in this particular school. And of course, I'm not negating what's happening in other schools, because I don't know. But you know, the school social worker is amazing. Just really has believed in social emotional learning, not only for the kids, but for the teachers. And I think that's really has really paid off. And if we just keep at it and the teachers keep at it and keep implementing social emotional learning throughout the day. You know, whether it's, you know, let's put our heads down for a minute before we start our math test, or let's listen to nice music, or let's talk about, you know, what's going well for in the day, you know, just little things throughout the day that aren't necessarily quote unquote mindfulness, but they're a reminder to just keep checking in with the heart and the body and the mind, you know, as often as you can throughout the day. And of course, I'm a huge fan of breath and its superpower to help us self-regulate.
Yeah, I love that. I'm so glad you brought up older children like us, you know, parents, teachers, educators, things like that. Let's start with educators. What other ways can educators foster, I guess, like more mindfulness when they're already busy teaching whatever their curriculum is?
Yeah, you know, transitions, I think, are really important. So, you know, let's walk to recess, you know, as slowly as we can, or let's take, you know, let's do breathing ball breath as we walk down the hall, you know, where you put your fingers together and you just breathe and you make your hands look like a ball, and then you breathe out and you make them look small again. So just doing simple things like that, to remind the kids that they can help themselves self-regulate, especially during and after and before a transition. It's just a really simple way to help kids in that regard.
Does the school become a sort of safe zone for some of the children who maybe have domestic issues? I know you work with, can I say like lower income kind of families, or, yes, or like lower resource kind of schools?
That's correct.
Does the school become like a real safe haven for the child at that point?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I was mentioning, the school social worker is really on it. We have a nurse as well. And so, yeah, so the kids really feel, I think, safe and nurtured and cared for in the school. But, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, there's lots of different kids from lots of different socio and economic backgrounds, but most of them, I think it would be called a Title I school, although I've never actually asked that. However, we do give every kid free lunches. And yeah, you know, just, I don't really want to know too much about what's going on at home because I'm only with kids for 25 to 30 minutes. So I try to keep it, for lack of a better word, light and playful, rather than, you know, find out, you know, too many secrets that they might be having at home.
Sure.
You know, sometimes a kid will say, you know, you know, they'll be sad and they'll say, oh, my parents are getting a divorce, or, you know, my uncle died, or, you know, and I just, my heart breaks for them, but, there's a lot going on in these kids' young lives, and it's painful to watch. And that's why I think it's so important that teachers show up with kindness and care and curiosity, and compassion, so the kids have something to model that looks like a healthy adult. Because, you know, when you're food insecure and you're home insecure and your relationship insecure, you're not going to show up, you know, like a functioning adult often. You're just going to be in fight, flight, or freeze. So I think you're going to be making choices that don't feel really great, especially to your kids. So I think it's incumbent upon the teachers to show up in that way, so the kids have something to latch on to.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder also, for parents that do want to raise their children more mindfully, what other things can they be thinking of themselves so that they can help foster that mindfulness in their children?
Well, I think that them having their own mindfulness practice is a really great way to start. You know, it could just be, you know, 5 minutes in the morning, even before getting out of bed, or maybe, you know, go downstairs and get your favorite breakfast drink, you know, coffee or tea or whatever, orange juice, and just sit there for, you know, 5 minutes and just enjoy the beverage and breathe and, maybe do a gratitude practice. Think about the things that you're thankful for, you know, that day or that night, the day before. And also, you know, you could do a little word that comes to mind is mantra, but that's not really what I want to say. But, you know, today may I be kind. Today may I be focused. Today may I be curious. And just see how that feels in the body and in the heart and in the mind. And I would start there. And then if the kids want to join you, I think that's a great way to do it. I think doing some sort of fun breath work with them, like the breathing ball breath or coyote breathing. If people go to my YouTube channel, I think there's like 30 different ways to breathe. And then I also have cards that go along with that. If people want to get the breathing cards, I have them on my website, so people can get those. So that way it can be a really interactive thing with parents and kids. So before going to bed, you could choose your favorite way to breathe, you know, like dolphin breathing or Spider-Man breathing or Wonder Woman breathing, just as a sweet little way to connect with each other as they go to sleep.
To the listener, like, definitely, unless you're driving, stop whatever you're doing right now and go over to Andrew's website. The amount of resources that you and the center puts out is incredible. For children, for teachers, for educators, for parents, for people like me who are none of those, it's amazing all the stuff that you put on there. I really wanted to talk to you about the breathing cards. I decided I was going to do the shark fin breathing today.
Good.
Yeah. I feel like a shark today. So can you tell us a little bit about that and in a little bit greater detail? I know that even like the list of all the cards is on your website. You can just go and see anytime without having to actually purchase the cards, but the cards look beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. I made them myself. I went to playingcards.com and I made 50 different ways to breathe, and I have beautiful illustrations on the front, and then on the back I have the directions. And a lot of teachers will start their class that way, that, you know, a kid will choose a card and that's how they'll breathe that particular day. So it might be snake breathing or air balloon breathing or water faucet breathing or wave breathing. You know, the list goes on and on. So yeah, you can go to my website and just read the directions there, and you could just copy that, you know, page and cut them up into little pieces of paper and then put them in a little baggie or bowl or something. And the kids in your class or at home could just, you know, do it as easily as that. And they're just really helpful ways, because like I said, I think the breath is the first step. First, we got to take a breath. There's a great acronym. It's called STOP, and it stands for stop your body, try and breathe, observe your feelings, and then peacefully proceed. And so if we can just remember to do those four things, we're going to be more skillful. And if we can't remember to breathe, things usually don't turn out so well. Sometimes, yes, we do need to be reactionary when like something's being thrown at us. We certainly need to just be our most primal and catch the ball or catch the stick or catch the chair or whatever's flying towards us. But most of the time, responding is the way to go. So those cards really come in handy. And like I said, I want the kids to learn that new habit of when in doubt, take a breath. So that's why I think they're so crucial to a mindfulness practice.
Yeah, I love that. Are they correlated to like a certain feeling? Like if a child says they feel sad, then they get the squirrel breathing card? Or is it just the point is just to pick an animal that you relate to today and breathe in a certain way?
That's really what it is. It's to make it fun. You know, I think sometimes, you know, you think of mindfulness and you think of like a yogi sitting on a mountaintop or, you know, flowing robes or something. And it all seems very kind of woo-woo or heady or, and I just want the kids to realize that this is just, this can be fun. You know, this can be playful. You know, I think life is at its best when we just roll with things, you know, and we're just more, more puppy-like, if you will, just enjoying it all, you know, and be curious about, you know, even when you're feel like I've had some, you know, sadness lately and just like, just to be curious about the sadness is so much more helpful than like, oh, you know, pull it together. Things are going to be work out fine. You know, like you were talking about with your friend, you know, sometimes you just have to say, okay, wow, this is big stuff. Where is this showing up in my body? Okay. And I feel sad in my cheeks, you know, my eyes feel puffy. You know, my hands are tingling. My eyebrows feel furrowed, you know, whatever it is, just really just get curious and welcome it. This little kid the other day, she came up to me after class and she said, I feel sad. And I said, I did that whole body scan I was telling you about. And then I said, you know, it's okay to still feel sad. Even if, you know, we just did that body scan and it's still there. I said, just feel like you're trying to comfort like a little sister that you have, you know, and just hold her, you know, hold her in that sadness. You don't have to, you know, tell her to get rid of it or shake it off, you know, just be with it. And maybe it'll just fade away on its own.
That's fantastic. I love that so much. Can you tell us a little bit about your other books?
Sure. So I have The Lion in Me, which is about naming and taming that inner beast. And it's a really cool sort of Where's Waldo book. Every page has a lion on it, and you sort of have to find the lion, and it might be in a puddle or in the clouds or in a mirror or in the shadows. And it's all about noticing what the body does before it erupts, you know? So the face gets hot, the fists clench, the belly tightens, the shoulders go up. And if we can notice, like I was saying earlier, if we can notice these signals, then we're able to be more skillful with the big emotion. So I really love it. It's certainly not about getting rid of anger. It's about not having it control us, you know, because, you know, we've all been there where we say or do things in the heat of anger and you have to just, you know, do so much repair afterwards. And no one wants to do that. It feels, you know, good to do the repair in some level because you're making amends, but you know, you don't even want to get there in the first place. You know, you want to just be able to, you know, just be able to talk it out rather than say, you know, vulgar or awful things or do things that just feel horrible to yourself and to others. And, you know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Well, totally. And I have to say too, like I got to watch you read the book out loud and show the pictures, and I haven't been read to in like 30 years. It made me want to like run downstairs and grab my blankie, which I still have, and like make a little fort in the living room and get read to. It was great. Just delightful.
Anytime. I love that. That's great. And then of course I've got the whole curriculum called Mindful Arts in the Classroom. And that's almost a 300 page curriculum that has all sorts of stories in it, from all over the world. There's an African folktale, there's an Indian folktale, there's a Native American folktale, Chinese, all sorts of stories that I've adapted to sort of give it my own sort of touch, if you will, sort of a mindfulness touch. And then there's lots of art activities within the book. There's lots of theater games. Yeah, it's just a really comprehensive book that you can use kind of as a script as you go through your year with your kids. And then the last one is The Barefoot King, which just came out not this past summer, but the summer before. And it's about a young king who stubs his toe and tries to change the world, but he winds up learning how to change his mind instead. And basically he wants to try to cover the world with leather so he's never hurt again because he stubs his toe. And he finds that causes all sorts of problems. And if we sort of try to live our lives like, you know, Don Quixote trying to fight windmills and fix everything, you know, and it just winds up exhausting us rather than changing the world. So we have to start inward in order to begin to change the world, you know, and that's the concept of that book. And so he winds up learning that he can actually just put leather on his shoe, on his feet, and call it shoes rather than having to cover the whole world. So, and that's basically what we're trying to do with our minds, is just not have it, you know, just get frustrated all the time by all of life's, you know, inconsistencies.
Sure. What a great message. Are you planning on writing any other books?
Yes, I have tons of books that I have in my arsenal that I want to have get published, but I'm not that great these days about pushing to get them published. So I think it might be laziness or maybe contentedness. I'm not sure, but I do have a writing group that I belong to. So every month we're asked to bring a new children's story. And in fact, I just wrote one on having two deaf parents. And it's going to be on an online resource page. And I can't remember what that's called, but it's about a little boy who has two moms and they're deaf, and they're walking down the street and they find a little dog who's lost, and the moms don't know what to do and they can't hear. So they're signing to each other and signing to the kid. But the boy who can hear hears the owner calling from down the street. So he tells his parents that, oh, wait a minute, I can hear the owner. So let's go deliver the dog back to the owner. And so they do. And the little boy kind of saves the day. So it just shows that, the parents are proud of him, and that, you know, even when you're little, you can be of help to your parents, especially if they're hearing impaired. Wow. So yeah, sweet little story. So that'll get published, online in the next few weeks. So.
Mm. Wow, what a beautiful story. I love it. We'll look forward to definitely more of your books in the future. It's interesting when somebody tries to improve themselves and they, you know, overcome the resistance and they get to work doing something, whether it's their health or fitness, it seems like once you get a little win in one category, it usually helps to improve other areas in your life. So for example, like you've changed your diet, now maybe you're going to want to work out more so that you don't kind of waste it. And so it's so often that mindfulness pops up in people's field of awareness when they start improving their health. So I want to ask you, for you personally, what other like lifestyle practices do you use to help keep you fit and healthy? I mean, I don't know why you told everybody on our podcast you're in your mid-50s. Clearly, that's not the case. what kinds of things do you do personally in your life to keep you at top shape?
Yeah, you know, I run as much as I can. I try to run at least once a week these days. I'd like to run more, but I don't know. I haven't been able to put it into my schedule. But what I am doing a lot is I swim in San Francisco Bay about three times a week. And in fact, next Sunday, a week from yesterday, I'm swimming from Alcatraz to San Francisco, which is about a mile and a half in about, I don't know, 55 degree water, not epically cold, but not warm.
I was just going to bring up Alcatraz. Like, have you found their bodies? Like, that's insane.
Right. I know. You know, apparently that was just a big PR move that the prison officials said to the prisoners was, you know, there's tons of sharks and the currents are crazy. So don't even think about swimming, because yes, there are sharks in the bay, but it's really, really rare that you see them, and they have never, knock wood, as far as I know, attacked anyone. They have attacked some seals, but you know, we don't wear wetsuits, so we don't look like seals. Sometimes sharks will go after people that were wearing wetsuits, but we don't tend to wear wetsuits. So yeah, so it's just, that's a real mindfulness practice to get into that cold water and just realize that, you know, I can do hard things and I use my breath to, you know, help me calm down if I get anxious or tired, or lose sort of the rhythm of the swim, or get out of sync with the waves. What I find really helpful, especially out in open water like that, is to kind of find the swells of the waves, and ride the waves, with some, you know, sort of just find that rhythm. Very much like mindfulness is, you know, find the waves of life and just ride them. And so I think I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be a beautiful swim. It's early in the morning, so the water tends to be calm. And I'll just, you know, look around and see the Golden Gate Bridge and the city and Alcatraz and my other swimmers and just sort of enjoy the ride.
Wow. That's amazing. I don't know that I would be able to enjoy that to that level that you would. Yeah. I would just say, like, if I'm not there, I would just start without me, I would say.
Okay. All right. Good.
I love the work you're doing with Mindful Arts San Francisco. If somebody wanted to volunteer, is that something they can do from anywhere in the world? Do they need to be in San Francisco to help out with that effort? How can people work with you?
Right. So during COVID, when we were doing everything online, anyone in California could volunteer to be a mindfulness teacher. And however, now that we're back in the classroom, we are looking for people in San Francisco or the Bay Area who can come in and teach at San Francisco schools for just about an hour a week. What we try to do is we try to link the volunteer up with two classrooms. So they go in for 25 to 30 minutes, then they might have a, you know, a few minute break, and then they go in and they teach the next class. So they're there for an entire hour once a week, and they do a curriculum that, you know, is basically Mindful Arts in the Classroom, the book I just mentioned. And they can look at my YouTube videos as well. I've recorded about 10 to 12 of the lessons, so they can look at those to see how I might teach the lesson. And then what's been interesting in the last few years since the book has come out is people have been wanting to start their own programs around the United States. So I think there's someone who's starting one in New Jersey, someone starting one in Los Angeles, Sacramento, and I think there's one or two other places that I can't think of right now. But, you know, and I always say start small. You know, if you're interested in bringing mindfulness into a classroom, just start there. You don't have to do the whole school. You might want to just talk to that teacher about it rather than talk to the principal or the social worker, because oftentimes a school social worker or a principal might feel overwhelmed and imagine that it's just going to be one more thing for them to have to supervise. So just start small and go with one teacher who will be willing to have you come in for, you know, three or four times, and then you could both reassess if it's been successful and would you like me to continue on for the, you know, rest of the year.
Interesting. Even if somebody is not in an area where this program is being run, it seems so helpful for any teacher, really anybody in general, to go through the program and just learn these tools. Do you feel like it applies to a much broader range of people?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and there are all sorts of curriculums out there, like Mindful Schools, where I first studied. I took about four classes with them, has a great curriculum that you can take online and be anywhere in the world to do that. We have an upcoming training, I think, on November 5th and January 6th, I think. The November date doesn't seem right. I think it's like November 18th. If people are interested and they live in San Francisco or the Bay Area and they want to check it out, or even if you're interested in taking the training because you're interested in doing your own work in a different part of the world, I bet the coordinator, her name is Siobhan George, would be willing to have you audit the training because, you know, that's the lovely part of Zoom is that you can have 100 or 1,000 people on it. And it's, you know, sort of the more the merrier.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because that's what I kind of wanted to close this conversation with. We went through, you know, the pandemic, and I don't know if you heard we had a pandemic, but we did.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of horribleness happened and, you know, it was difficult to understand. And I don't blame anybody for thinking anything about whatever they want. It was all really confusing. But a lot of people just kind of sat around or complained about everything or went to social media to complain there. And, you know, I really appreciate people who saw the situation as just, this is what's happening. Let's adjust to this and make the best out of this. So my question is, during the pandemic, what were some of the best things that ever happened for you personally and for, you know, increasing mindfulness in schools or anywhere else?
Right. Well, certainly swimming in the bay became a really important lifeline for me. What's interesting is I just made so many more connections with people because we'd all, you know, everything was closed. We have a club called the Dolphin Club that's, you know, a building with a sauna room and showers and lockers and all that. But they closed that during the pandemic. So we all had to meet out on these bleachers. And so therefore, all the women and the men were getting to know each other better and swimming together. Because we don't, of course, have co-ed lockers, but the bleachers, of course, were co-ed. So we were all getting to know each other more. And so now I've connected with all these people that I wouldn't have normally been able to hang out with as easily. And certainly my mindfulness practice was a huge benefit to me, because you're absolutely right. If we can just stay in the moment, you know, life is okay. Usually, if you're listening to this, you have a phone or a computer or a place that you call home. It's when we start moving away from the present moment that we start stressing ourselves out. So, you know, oh my gosh, you know, tomorrow I've got to do this thing, or, you know, yesterday that thing went badly. But if we just stay in the moment, there's not a lot going on often that's worrisome, you know. Yes, someone might be sick or whatnot, but right now they're alive and they're, you know, fighting or, you know, whatever it might be. In this moment, things can be okay most of the time. Certainly, you know, things arise that are really not good and we have to try to solve the situation and get out of it. But that's also when we want to be present. We don't want to freak out. We don't want to go to the worst case scenario or catastrophize. We want to think, okay, this is terrible. What do we do next that's going to help us feel okay in the next moment and the next moment and the next?
I don't know where I picked this up, but I always ask myself the question, like, what at this moment is lacking? You know, what's going on right now? And you're right. Sometimes there are things that you need to deal with that are in front of you, but oftentimes there's really not. And so I think that's wonderful advice. Andrew, this has been an amazing conversation. Where would you like people to go to find you and find your work?
Thank you. They can go to Andrew J. Initial Nance, NANCE.com. Or they can check out mindfulartssf.org to find out more information about volunteering or donating, for that matter, to our work. And we had 40 volunteers that got to see over 1,000 kids in San Francisco in the public schools. So we feel really proud of that.
Wow.
And feeling very grateful.
That's amazing. Dude, what a fun conversation. And just to connect with somebody who is changing lives at the most fundamental level and giving such a wonderful gift, like you said, the tools to be able to deal with things down the road. I'm just so grateful for the book, which I absolutely love, Puppy Mind. And I'm very proud to say that this will be something that I will hand down to my child when I have one. So just so grateful for you and for your work. And thank you for everything that you've done. And thank you for coming on our show today. It's been a real honor.
Thank you so much, Casey. This was a pleasure.
Absolutely. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio.